You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part B. Here's the continuation of Murder at Hammersmith Farm by James Robinault. But let's return for a moment to June. On the 11th, Kennedy went on national television to plead for racial peace and justice following the obstruction of desegregation efforts at the University of Alabama by Governor George Wallace. This was a dramatic and controversial change to John and Robert Kennedy's previously cautious approach to civil rights. The pair understood that Democrats at the time held national office only by the favor of voters in the solidly Democratic South. Kennedy asked Americans to examine their consciences and consider new legislation, which, after his death, would become the historic Civil Rights Act of 1964. As if to underscore the seriousness of the threats to African Americans, later that night, the NAACP's Medgar Evers was gunned down by a sniper with a scope. 11 days later, JFK flew to Europe. In West Berlin, he delivered one of the most majestic pronouncements of his presidency, speaking to cheering throngs gathered in front of the city hall of the divided city. Today, in the world of freedom, the proudest boast is Ich bin ein Berliner. From Germany, Kennedy flew to Ireland to visit the homeland of his ancestors. It was a highly sentimental time, with adoring crowds rushing around him and crushing. These were the three happiest days I've ever spent in my life, he privately told one of the hosts just before departing. He continued on to Italy, making his way to the Vatican for an audience with the recently installed Pope Paul VI. By July 4th, JFK was ensconced in Hyannisport, basking in the accomplishments of a marathon month. But then, quite dramatically, the energy began to shift. On August 7th, the First Lady decided to accompany her 5-year-old daughter Caroline to horseback riding lessons at Alley Farm in Osterville, 6 miles west of Hyannisport. Jackie was 8 months pregnant and had limited her activities. She had a history of difficult pregnancies, including a miscarriage, a stillbirth, and her son John F. Kennedy Jr.'s premature birth. Landis noticed Jackie walking toward him with deliberation shortly after their arrival. She said they had to leave immediately, but asked him not to interrupt Caroline's lesson. Landis drove her back to Hyannis, a bumpy ride. Then a helicopter transported both of them to the military's hospital at Otis Air Force Base, where doctors performed a cesarean birth. The baby boy, Patrick, was 5.5 weeks premature, his lungs not fully developed. After being taken to a Boston hospital, Patrick died on August 9th in a high-pressure hyperbaric chamber as the president held his tiny hand. JFK's desperate prayers for the life of his second son echoed his own father's prayers for him when he was just 2 and hospitalized in Boston with scarlet fever, his temperature spiking to 105. Through his grief, might Kennedy have wondered if Patrick's death presaged his own? At the very least, the president was forced to intensify his focus on his life's priorities. What is certain is that his behavior changed. He renewed his close relationship with Jackie, and according to biographer Clark, ceased his rampant womanizing. Knowing that Jackie had suffered from severe postpartum depression in the past, Kennedy was determined to keep her spirits up. "You know, Jackie," he said, "we must not create an atmosphere of sadness in the White House, because this would not be good for anyone, not for the country, and not for the work we have to do." Clark observed His reference to the work we have to do stressed their partnership in a way that Jackie had to find gratifying and promising. According to her mother, it made a profound impression on her. Realizing that Jackie needed some time to get away and process her grief, her sister, Lee Radziwill, asked her to come along on a trip to Greece a few weeks later. Though JFK at first had been concerned about the optics of such a trip, especially since Radziwill reputedly was having an affair with Greek shipping magnate Aristotle Onassis, Jackie would marry Onassis in 1968. Kennedy, at his wife's insistence, eventually relented. In October, the sisters departed, accompanied by agents Landis and Clint Hill. While in Greece, says Landis, Jackie confided that she would soon join her husband on a domestic political trip, something she had mostly avoided. Landis understood the First Lady's decision. He, too, recognized a reinvigorated bond between the two, sensing that they were determined to spend more time together. It was during this period of trying to lighten the mood that the President and First Lady came up with the idea of a home movie. JFK was clowning with Faye. Jackie had her interest in photography and directing, and JFK loved the James Bond books, as well as movies in general. He had spent time in Hollywood, where his father had run three film studios. Kennedy even thought of writing his own spy novels. JFK's interest in 007 author Ian Fleming had begun in 1954 when he read Casino Royale while recovering from back surgery. He met privately with Fleming during the 1960 campaign. A year later, when Time Life correspondent Hugh Seide wrote about the new president's reading habits, Kennedy praised Fleming's work. Like many of the world's leaders, Seide noted, he has a weakness for detective stories, especially those of British author Ian Fleming and his fictitious undercover man James Bond. At the time, Bond thrillers were only beginning to catch on in America, but with Kennedy's endorsement, sales soared. The first 007 movie, Dr. No, hit U.S. theaters in May 1963. At some point that summer, the president, on a lark, sketched out a script for his own short humorous film. Navy Chief Robert L. Knutson was JFK and Jackie's go-to person for home movies in Newport. Records from the projectionist of the White House screening room show that Jackie, while enjoying a variety of films there, took immense pleasure in watching family footage. Tech reporter Matt Novak of Gizmodo wrote in 2016, "The films that Jackie Kennedy watched in the White House are a mixture of diplomatic necessity, USIA propaganda movies, familial bonding, cartoons and home movies, and high-class foreign films." Of course, some of the films are perhaps better described as middlebrow and included at least two James Bond movies. Knutson's story is not well known. An Iowa native, he was nearly the same age as Jackie. While she was in Paris in college, Knutson, having graduated first in his class at the Naval Photographic School, was just starting as a personal photographer for President Harry Truman. When Dwight Eisenhower became president, Knutson thought his career in the White House was over. Knutson was Navy. Eisenhower and his top staff were Army. In fact, Cecil Stoughton, an Army Signal Corps sergeant, later promoted to captain, was brought on board to take up photographic chores. Even so, Eisenhower kept Knutson on the dole. Rather savvy about PR, the new president, who would hire actor Robert Montgomery as the first full-time White House consultant to engage with industry leaders in Hollywood, understood the importance of disseminating pictures to the public and the press. At Ike's suggestion, Knutson located a storage space on the ground floor of the West Wing to establish quarters for the White House photo staff in order to be closer to the action in the Oval Office. When JFK won the presidency in 1960, Knutson knew he would have an in with a former naval officer. To his good fortune, he ended up serving six presidents, from Truman to Ford. But he was especially close to Kennedy. K capturing some of the most iconic photos of JFK in Berlin and Ireland. For this article, Landis and I interviewed Knudsen's son, also a photographer and also named Robert Knudsen. His father died in 1989. The younger Knudsen, who lives outside Washington, D.C., told us that the film of the staged murder had been shot and edited by his father. He recounted how the amateur movie was meant to loosely parody a Bond caper and that the First Lady, a film buff, had directed each scene. Once completed, a duplicate of the edited movie, he said, had been sent to Red Fay. Another went to Jackie. No other copies are thought to exist. Knudsen believes that Fay, perhaps distraught after the assassination, destroyed his copy. Knudsen has no idea what became of Jackie's. But fortunately for history, Knudsen's father kept some of the footage used to make the film, snippets of which are still in the son's possession. In all, Knudsen has approximately 7 minutes from the original shoots, which he screened for me at his home in Virginia. For security reasons, all of his father's materials are maintained off-site. Knudsen is cooperating with the production company Moxie Pictures on a documentary based on Landis's book, The Final Witness. As it turns out, there were multiple parts to the staged movie. The only time the elder Knudsen spoke about this filming with the press was right after Ralph Martin's book was released, 20 years after the assassination. He told the Associated Press that Kennedy wrote the script and that for each scene there had been several different takes. In some, JFK is the person shot. In others, Fay is the person who falls. In amateur fashion, they had used Heinz ketchup to make it appear as though they were bleeding. The first scene was enacted on the Newport Pier that led to Hammersmith Farm. In this clip, the presidential party exits the Honey Fits. Then, JFK suddenly clutches his chest and falls as if hit by bullets. And in an absurd touch, those behind him nonchalantly step over him. Fay then trips and falls on top of the president, and a gush of red surged from the president's mouth, soiling the front of his shirt. The whole vibe of the film was less Bond than the detective spoof The Pink Panther, which would premiere in theaters the following March. Unbeknownst to the Kennedys or the actors, two reporters in a nearby chase boat, Frank Cormier of AP and Merriman Smith of UPI, were watching the group through binoculars. A photographer with them, likely a Newport freelancer or an AP staffer or stringer, had a camera with a zoom lens. Knudsen's son has two prints from that long-ago shoot, which, as far as he knows, have never surfaced. At the time, the reporters only wrote about the version of the home movie in which Fay is the victim. One of the photos shows Knudsen in a business suit, perched atop a pier post with his movie camera, eerily foreshadowing amateur photographer Abraham Sapruder standing on a concrete abutment in Dealey Plaza in Dallas 2 months later. Off to the side, JFK holds a towel, presumably using it to clean off the ketchup that had spurted from his mouth. Jackie stands next to Knudsen, looking like she is directing the scene. Two children are also visible, Caroline and Marcantonio Crespi, the son of Countess Vivian Stokes Crespi. The Countess was also a guest that weekend. She and Jackie had met in Newport, where their mothers were friends. A statuesque blonde, Vivi had married an Italian-Brazilian count, Marco Fabio Crespi, but the two were in divorce proceedings by then. Their only child, Marco Antonio, became a childhood companion of Caroline's. A small article, sans photo, ran on the AP wire that night and was picked up in newspapers, describing the scene at the pier, along with headlines such as Kennedy's cut up for camera at weekend retreat, and Kennedy's Fay get big scene down on film. But the reporters were not privy to the action filmed at the Hammersmith Mansion. A sequence shot by Knudsen in front of the house was taken from a third-floor balcony. It shows a station wagon full of Secret Service agents racing from their command post and screeching to a halt before eight of them jump out. The actors, at Jackie's urging, were actual agents, including Roy Kellerman, Jerry Blaine, Art Godfrey, and Landis. "We're making a movie about the president's murder," she told them, "and we'd like you and the other agents to drive up to the front of the house, then jump out and run toward the door." So they did. And when they entered, according to Landis, they found the president lying in the foyer. Jackie, sitting on the stairs leading to the second floor, nodded as they ran in, while Knudsen kept filming. Everyone applauded when she said cut. "I asked Landis to authenticate what remains of Knudsen's footage. Sure enough, the film shows the agents, including Landis, scrambling out of a station wagon in front of Hammersmith Farm, looking startled and then laughing. The third series of scenes was taken behind the house. In these vignettes, a love triangle is played out between Crespi, Fay, and Jackie's stepbrother, Hugh D. Yusha Auchincloss, who lived in a separate home on Hammersmith Farm. Both men practice cuddling with the Countess, while the other happens upon them, and startled by what he sees, retreats from the room. Jealousy appears to end in the murder of one of the secret lovers. There are other miscellaneous takes filmed on the Honey Fits that variously show Jackie directing and JFK sitting next to Fay, who has a rope around his neck, and ketchup on his mouth and shoulder, as well as scenes in which the Countess and Fay drop a pistol into a bag that is then surreptitiously spirited away. In related footage, Jackie carries the bag with the pistol, either directing or acting in the movie. On Sunday, the day after the reporters witnessed the action on the pier, Knudsen reported for work at Hammersmith Farm before the Kennedys were about to go to church, and was told that the president was furious with him. He was flummoxed. What had he done? Apparently, JFK thought that Knudsen, who hadn't even read the AP item, had leaked the information that appeared in the story. He was summarily dismissed and told to head to the airport to return to Washington. But at the airport, he encountered either the reporters or the photographer, who shared both the article and two photographic prints, including one showing Knudsen standing on the pier with JFK. Knudsen immediately took the photos back to the president, who was relieved to see that the news story had not been the result of a leak by Knudsen. He had not wanted to fire the man he affectionately called Chief, who then dutifully went with the family to church. Knudsen quickly turned his attention to the movie, editing the scenes into a short film. Records from the White House Theater reveal that JFK and Jackie, accompanied by Fay and close family friend Bill Walton, screened home movies the next day, September 23rd. A week later, before Jackie left for Greece, she and JFK viewed the spy movie a second time with the Washington Post Ben Bradley, a confidant of the president, and Bradley's then-wife, socialite Toni Pinchot, an artist-designer who had been on the staff at Vogue and was a close friend of the First Lady's. Evidently, the Kennedys were keen to share their joint creation with the arts-oriented pair. The content of the film, no matter how lighthearted at the time, would prove ominous. Looking back, the elder Knudsen saw a prophecy. "I wondered if it was a premonition he had," he told the AP in 1983, "or a quirk of fate." Around this time, a psychiatrist in Palm Beach, where the Kennedys had a winter compound, spoke with the press about his own personal knowledge of JFK's premonitions. McKinley Cheshire said of the home movie, "It could easily have been just a fantasy to release a lot of his own internal fears and counter his own phobic behavior, an effort to face the reality that his life was indeed in great danger." He also sensed that the president allowing others to step over his fallen body was his way of saying they must carry on without him. If JFK had harbored any premonitions about his death at that point, they were clearly not specific enough to persuade him to change his plans to go to Dallas. There is another oddity in the narrative that would hint at the misfortune to follow. The Kennedys watched dozens and dozens of films in the White House theater during JFK's time in office, and the official logs of their screenings contain an intriguing entry on August 29, 1962. That day, Kennedy, along with his brother Robert, viewed the soon-to-be-released movie The Manchurian Candidate, the neo-noir thriller starring Frank Sinatra about a U.S. serviceman who is captured by Soviet and Chinese agents in Korea and brainwashed to kill a presidential candidate. The penultimate scene shows the murderer loading a gun that resembles the bolt-action rifle used by Lee Harvey Oswald in JFK's assassination. Oswald, as it turns out, was a Marine who had spent time in the Soviet Union. Reportedly, Sinatra had approached JFK to ask for his sign-off before appearing in the picture, portraying the character who attempts to foil the assassin's plot. In hindsight, the coincidences between these filmed fictions and cold reality are chilling. Knudsen was not in Dallas on November 22nd. Why? His son says that it was, in his words, another quirk of fate. His father had suffered an injury while working on antique furniture when a splinter flew into his eye, resulting in a brief trip to the hospital. He was recovering when JFK called to tell him of an upcoming trip to Miami, Tampa, and Dallas. Learning of Knudsen's condition, he told Chief to take the week off. "I'm going down to Florida and then over to Dallas with Lyndon to get some more votes, and nothing's going to happen," the president said. "Be with your family. Enjoy them. We need to spend more time with our families." The next time Knudsen would see the president would be in the morgue at Bethesda Naval Hospital, where he was tasked with taking autopsy photos. Those lost photos comprise a different tale about lost film footage. But that's another story.
Thank you.
Girls Interrupted by Evgenia Peretz. Nestled in the Berkshires, with a pedigree dating back to 1898, Miss Hall's school appears to be a cocoon of safety and formative tutelage for its students, all of them young women. But for decades, an alleged sexual predator operated on campus. Now alumni are speaking out in hopes of holding their former teacher and the school accountable. Opening photograph by Mark Seliger. Hillary Simon and Melissa Fairs, photographed in Far Rockaway, New York, November 2024. Matt Rutledge was watching television with Annie, his wife of 35 years, when the bombshell phone call came in. On the other end was Julia Heaton, the head of school at Miss Hall's, the small all-girls boarding school across the street in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, where for three decades, since 1991, Rutledge had been the star history teacher and a charismatic face of the school. Heaton had bad news to share. The school had received a letter accusing Rutledge of sexual misconduct with a former student. Frantic, he texted Hillary Simon, his former student and advisee. "If this is related to you and me," he wrote, "I am so sorry. I am not sure how to conduct myself here, other than knowing that I can only offer a blanket denial and decline the opportunity to say more than that to anyone who asks to speak to me. I'm shaking as I type this, because I'm terrified, of course, but I don't really know what else to do." As she read it, Simon was shaking. She thought she'd die with their secret, that when he was 40 and she was 15, he'd sought her out and eventually began a sexual relationship that lasted well into her 20s. He'd cajoled her, obsessed over her. She was sure she was the only one. By the end of their conversation, in spite of herself, she found herself promising to gather what information she could to try to help him. A problem like Rutledge was the kind of thing that elite educational institutions swept under the rug in the 1980s and 90s. By the 2010s, private schools across the country had begun reckoning with instances of sexual abuse by faculty members. Astonishingly, Miss Hall's seemed to have made the gamble to keep silent, even as the world around it changed. The school declined to respond to Vanity Fair's questions pending an ongoing investigation. Now stories about Rutledge are flooding out from a group of brave women going back decades, and they all bear striking similarities in their specific patterns. Their stories are similar in another way, too, in that they center on the most vulnerable part of girlhood and of growing up, the time when a person's beliefs and identity are taking shape, and if that vulnerability is pierced, it can shatter a life forever. Next photo, Simon with Matt Rutledge at her 2005 graduation. "I still struggle with feelings of shame and self-disgust. That's a big one lately," says Melissa Fairs, who until the past boiled up and sent her life sideways, was a reporter at Reuters. "We're in the kitchen of her childhood home in Wilton, Connecticut, where Rutledge once read to her from Pooh and Friends on the floor as she, then 16, fell asleep on his shoulder. She's warm and down to earth, wearing shorts and a tie-dyed sweatshirt. Wine is on hand if needed," she tells me. Her sharp, spirited, and slightly nervous mother, Christina, bustles in and out from her cigarette breaks on the hammock overlooking her gardens. She fixes drinks and sandwiches, then stops in her tracks and asks whether Melissa really wants her there. Melissa assures her that she does. Rutledge got his hooks into Christina, too, much to her embarrassment. And at this point, there's no detail her mother can't hear, though at one time Fairs, like Hillary Simon, thought she'd die with her secret, too. "I feel disgusted, obviously, mostly by him," says Fairs. "But there's part of me that feels like he injected his shame into me. That's just lasted for so many years," she says. "He was inside of me physically, but literally infiltrated my life, my family's life, my mom's life, my dad's life, my brother, everybody. In 2006, Fares was 14 and felt lost in the crowd at the public school she was attending. She told her parents that she wanted more academic attention and became fixated on going to boarding school. Her strict father, Nabil, an emigre from Lebanon, was reluctant, but agreed under the condition that it be an all-girls school. After the family visited a few, one rose to the top, Miss Halls. The idyllic Berkshire jewel, with fewer than 200 students in the student body and a price tag of up to $72,000 for a year of tuition, had an attractive pedigree. Founded in 1898, it was the first all-girls boarding school in Massachusetts. Like Miss Porter's, Emma Willard, and other historic all-girls schools that dot New England, it promised, still promises, women's empowerment in a testosterone-free environment. But Jeannie Norris, then the head of school, touted a specific brand of women's leadership, rooted in what alumna calls respectability politics. Being ladylike was important. Gossiping about one's elders was sacrilege. Issues around sex and sexuality were circumscribed. For any parent hoping for a safe, cosseting environment, this one seemed to fit the bill. On their visit, the Fairses were invited to sit in on the American history class of Matt Rutledge, who had knocked their socks off with his charisma. The Fairses were sold. Miss Halls wasn't the easy transition Fares had hoped for. Coming in as a sophomore, she found it hard to make friends. Rutledge, her history teacher, immediately identified that loneliness. He acknowledged how tough it must be for her. Focusing on her work would help her, he said. He promised he could make me a better writer, which was huge for me, Fares says now. His attention was a jolt. She'd been aware of his special status at the school since the day the Fairses had toured. He was a family man. He made sure people knew. A photo of his wife and kids hung outside his classroom, and his two daughters attended the school. Tall and imposing, he played a lot of hockey in the local league in Northampton. He had a cultured side, too. He wrote poetry, and in the summers he was the director of the Tanglewood Music Center's residential program at Miss Hall's. Boldly inhabiting his Renaissance man persona, he was known to start his first class of the year with, "I'm Matt Rutledge, as you know. I'm smart, funny, charming, handsome, and modest," to a chorus of awkward girlish titters. He strutted the halls, rattling off inside jokes to any student who might pass, sometimes calling out, "Make way for Mr. Wonderful." The comically over-the-top bluster was part of the charm. Or so it seemed to Fares. Others, including many of the teachers, had a hunch that his arrogance was compensating for insecurity. "He had a shit childhood," says a former teacher who knew him well, pointing to parents who divorced when he was young and an absent father. His academic bona fides weren't especially sparkly. Berkshire Community College and University of Massachusetts Amherst. He started a PhD program at UMass, writing about the Gilded Age mansions of the Berkshires, but didn't complete it. He'd harbored dreams of being a writer, but they never panned out. "He was a big fish in a small pond," says another former faculty member. "That's how we thought of him, as kind of pathetic and insecure. He was only strong within those walls." Next photos, Rutledge and Simon with her cross-country teammates. Rutledge and Fares in Wilton, Connecticut, in the summer of 2008. To Fares, Rutledge was the big man on campus, bar none. She began going to his study halls in his classroom, where she says they'd usually be alone. On such evenings, he'd outfit his room with debonair touches, snacks like dried cherries, raw almonds, and fancy dark chocolate from Canada, where he had a cabin. He'd have cool music playing, Stevie Ray Vaughan, The Police, Van Morrison. He'd encourage her to take a nap if she was sleepy. He thrilled in the size differential, it seemed. "I don't want to say twice my height, but he towered above me," says Fares, who is 5'4". He began to call her Little One, and would comment, for instance, "Such a big sigh for such a little girl." Rutledge did not respond to detailed questions from Vanity Fair. As their sessions continued, his conversations became more daring. "You're my type," he told her one evening. "Dark hair, dark eyes, like Penelope Cruz or Salma Hayek." "Penelope Cruz," she remembers thinking, "I'll take it." He'd share stories about his own youth, blighted by drugs and bad characters, and the sad state of his marriage. He and his wife hadn't had sex for ages. Then he'd drop in a question about her boyfriend back home. He asked if he had performed oral sex on me, she recalls. He'd put his legs up on the table and encourage her to rest her legs on his. He began giving her mixtapes, with songs like Sweet Thing by Van Morrison, Fields of Gold by Sting, Let's Give 'Em Something to Talk About by Bonnie Raitt. Pulse racing, she'd study the lyrics for signs of his desire. On Friday night school trips to the Berkshire Mall, he drove the van and had her sit beside him with the other girls in the back. He'd have one hand on the wheel and the other on her thigh. "I'm thinking, this man has lost his mind," Fares recalls. "He must be obsessed with me. He can't resist me. He's taking these chances." Even with the heady emotional rush, Fares' loneliness hadn't subsided, and she was having doubts about returning the following year, which posed a problem for Norris. The board had hired Norris in 1996, when the school was in dire financial straits, and student retention was a serious problem. Norris, polished and formal, was remarkably successful in turning things around, raising $55 million in capital campaigns over what would ultimately be 16 years at the helm, for example, and she was determined not to let the school backslide. In the spring of 2008, Norris met with Fares' parents to discuss her happiness. As Christina Fares recalls, Norris asked if there were any teachers with whom Melissa was particularly close who might encourage her to stay on. "Matt Rutledge," Christina replied. She and Nabil had gotten to know him themselves. They'd even gone out to dinner with him on their visits to see their daughter. He'd been so helpful with her writing. "Then it was settled," Norris advised. "You two don't press," she suggested to the parents. "Let Rutledge take the lead." Norris did not respond to questions from Vanity Fair. That summer, the Fairs family invited him to visit their house in Wilton. Melissa sat by the guest cottage where he was to stay, anxiously awaiting his arrival. Rutledge came bearing gifts, a sun hat for Christina, an avid gardener, a book by the erudite British author Simon Winchester for Nabil, Pooh and Friends for Melissa. Melissa had her own gift to impart, a leather-bound scrapbook she'd made featuring images of cows, an inside joke, as he had a thing for cows and would mutter moo when Melissa said something he liked. When she gave it to him, tears formed in his eyes. The scrapbook was a sign that she'd be back in the fall. The next morning they went for a walk, and he took her hand as they strolled. When they got to a secluded dead end, he gave her a lingering embrace, so long that she braced excitedly for a kiss. He held off, for now. For the rest of the weekend, he gardened with Christina, played guitar with Melissa's brother, Emil, and talked college prospects with Nabil. Rutledge and the family enjoyed a hot tub together. They all went out for a sushi dinner, and he placed a hand on Melissa's leg under the table, a thrilling act of illicitness that promised more to come. "You stuffed me to perfection," he wrote in his four-page thank-you letter to the family. Upon Fares' return her junior fall, Rutledge became her advisor, signing off on her comings and goings and steering all of her relationships. He eagerly encouraged a new friendship with his younger daughter, who was a grade below and played defense with her on varsity soccer. As the two girls grew closer, he naturally saw more affairs. One day that fall, he took the girls to Great Barrington for ice cream. They found a creek bank to enjoy it on, and Rutledge's daughter sat in front of them. Fair sat near his casually splayed-out legs. Then right behind his daughter's back, literally, He kissed Fares for the first time. I was shocked, but I guess I just went with it because what else am I going to do, she says, perhaps voicing exactly his calculus. Whatever Fares' fears, they were eclipsed by her sense of intoxication. There's something about me that he loves, and it makes you feel like you're walking on water, she recalls. They were each other's protectors, he insisted, and the stakes couldn't be higher. If you ever tell anyone, I will kill myself, he told her. He was quick to cover their tracks, instructing her how to delete instant messages. But Fares didn't realize that their relationship was becoming evident to others. Her schoolmate, Bethany Fusini, now Bethany Whitney, class of 11, recalls the sight of them pulling up in the van together, side by side, with his daughter in the back. It just felt like he was with his girlfriend, Whitney says. During the same time period, he began corresponding with Fares' mother in long emails. He wove together guileless-sounding personal anecdotes about, say, Easter egg hunts gone awry, snippets intended to show his propriety. Melissa's birthday is coming up. I'd like to give her a couple of little things. Please let me know if you would prefer I didn't, okay? And read in a certain light, romanticish phrasing, my dear Christina, I'm glad to make you smile, of course. It makes me happy to do so. Hugs and kisses. He sent her his poetry, which he hoped the New Yorker would publish, a young birch tree to plant, and a Stevie Ray Vaughan CD collection. I was a sucker, admits Christina. I fell right into it. I was in the right frame of mind to welcome the attentions of an attractive man who, P.S., was really helping my daughter. He was still working on Melissa, too. One fall morning at dawn, his favorite time of day, he told her, she showed up at his classroom, as instructed, wearing her pajamas. He met her at the doorway, locked the door behind her, pulled down the shade. He told her to get under a classroom desk, took off her pajamas, and performed oral sex on her for the first time. A few months later, just after she had turned 17, the instructions got more elaborate. Come in your pajamas, but first go to the laundry room, located next to the classroom, and put in a load of laundry. A plausible excuse. This time he brought her to the closet, where he'd laid down a yoga mat, and he raped her. That's not what she called it at the time, but it was the first time she felt a sense of having been violated. People ask me, well, was it consensual? And I'm like, how do you give consent at that age, in that context? He's a big guy and was just forceful, so I didn't say anything, and he came inside me. She bled and she panicked. She wasn't on birth control. He assured her that he'd had a vasectomy, a term she'd never heard before. But if she wanted to have a baby with him, it could be reversed, he said. She went back to her dorm, googled vasectomy, and breathed a sigh of relief. Next photos, Fares, Rutledge, and Fares' mother during a family trip to Wilton, and the grounds of Miss Hall's school. As junior year turned to senior year, the sex became frequent, and he introduced her to alcohol, bottom shelf Evan Williams whiskey, encouraging her to take shots and imagine she was tasting the woods. He'd have sex with her in his guest room while his wife and daughters were sleeping. Rutledge again visited the Fares family in Wilton, this time with his daughter. Fares and the daughter shared Fares' bedroom, but Fares sneaked into the cottage, which he had dubbed the Rutledge Cottage, to have sex with him. In 2010, when Fares was 18 and ready for college, she chose Smith in Northampton, in part to stay close to him. The relationship took a darker turn still. He'd steal away from Pittsfield on a Sunday, telling his family he was going to hockey practice. He'd show up at her dorm with cases of wine. This was the beginning, she says, of her dependency on alcohol, something she would struggle with for years. He'd take her to the North King Motel, where he paid in cash. On occasion, he'd give her baby doll-style nighties. As she'd perform oral sex on him, he would film her from his laptop. This is all I have to remember you by, he'd tell her. He assured her the files were encrypted. Other nights, the action happened in his car. She apologizes for her language here, describes what he would ask her to do. Drive me around, go to the hospital, parking lot, give me a shot of whiskey, and make him orgasm, and then drop me back off. The thrill had turned into hollow degradation. She thought about telling friends, but the threat of him taking his own life continued to loom. She became increasingly isolated, routinely lying to her friends about her whereabouts. On nights when other girls were out socializing with one another, she often stayed in her room, alone, drinking the bottles of wine he'd brought her. By the time Fares reached her 20s, she tried to break his hold and see other men, but Rutledge did what he could to stop her. He gave her a vibrator and told her she didn't need to explore other relationships. Just use it and think of him. She moved to New York in 2014 to attend Columbia Journalism School, where she met a man she started dating. Rutledge created a fake Instagram account to follow her and saw a picture of them together. She recalls one night when she was in a taxi going to meet the new boyfriend. He called me, and he was screaming and crying. He was so hysterical, she says, completely unhinged. How could you do this to me? Fares, now 32, finally saw his monstrousness and repellence. But the damage felt irrevocable. She struggled in one relationship after another, often freezing during sex or dissociating. For a time, she could only perform the act while intoxicated. As she bluntly puts it, I always say, or have said to people recently, I don't know how to make love, I know how to F. At her fifth Miss Hall's reunion, she had sex with him for the last time at his mother's house. I just felt so little of myself. As Fares eventually entered therapy, some truths about herself and her experience began to crystallize. Why am I so good at lying? Well, he was so good at lying. Why do I feel so much shame? Well, the shame I feel is also his shame. And that's what predators, I think, do. They take their shame, they put it on you, and you have to carry it. One day in 2019, her story came tumbling out to her mother and then to her brother. Nabil, who died in 2021, had developed dementia, which spared Fares from having to tell him. Christina was heartbroken for her daughter, crushed with guilt for not seeing what was in front of her. She supported her in how she wanted to proceed with her story. Melissa knew coming out publicly would hurt Rutledge's daughter, with whom she had remained friends, and so she held back. But last March, she felt the need to speak up despite that friendship. I felt like I had forgiven myself enough to be able to come forward and speak from a place of, not authority, but some profound experience that this was not my fault, and this needs to be discussed. This man needs to not be able to teach ever again. Through a lawyer, Fair sent a letter to the current head of school, Julia Heaton, who began in 2014 and told her the headlines of her story. At the same time, she reached out to a woman she didn't know, but whose name she had heard, Hillary Simon, née Casper, class of 05. While Fares was at Miss Hall's, she'd heard whispers that he'd had a relationship with Simon when Simon attended the school 5 years earlier. Fares recalls Googling her back then. Simon was petite, with dark hair, dark eyes, just like her. At the time, Fares asked Rutledge about her, but he denied any involvement. He loved only her, he insisted, and this was his first time doing anything of the kind. Fares accepted it, but doubt nagged at her. Now, 15 years later, Fares decided to put out feelers to the woman. Maybe she'd had an experience similar to her own. That is where this story began. On the same morning that Simon received the frantic text from Rutledge, she went into her office, an insurance law firm in New York, and stared at the email from the lawyer representing Melissa Fares, a name she'd never heard of, asking to talk. She felt like she might throw up. It was now clear to her that Fares was the woman behind the complaint to the school. Her first reaction was jealousy, even though Simon was now married with a 3-year-old child. She promptly called Rutledge and unloaded, "Who is Melissa Fares?" Rutledge tap-danced on the phone, claiming Fares had been just the result of a midlife crisis and his unhappy marriage. And then Simon went into protection mode, as she had so many times before. She promised to collect information from Fares and report back. Simon, now 37, called Fares, but just moments into their conversation, hearing the voice of the young woman on the other end of the line, a switch went off, says Simon. She found herself saying, "I've been waiting for this call for 20 years. As she listened to Fares' story, a wave of sorrow fell over her. "I just remember feeling so sad that I didn't protect her, that I didn't stop him." Simon shared her story back. For both women, the sense of specialness they both once felt was peeled away. Their stories were twin accounts, 5 years apart and overlapping, marked by the same plot points and scenes. But there was a new angle to Simon's story, evidence that the school knew the truth about Rutledge and did nothing to stop him. Much like Fares, Simon is warm and intelligent, with a hint of grief behind a pretty face. Notes and photos of her with Rutledge sit in tidy piles on her dining room table. In them, she's baby-faced, eyes twinkling, barely up to his shoulder. Looking at one, she says that she's telling her story, at least in part, for that girl whose future he stole. Like Fares, 14-year-old Simon found it hard to make friends when she arrived at Miss Hall's in 2001. She was dealing with a family member's mental health issues that required all her parents' attention. "I was still reeling from a childhood of chaos and violence," she says. That first year, Rutledge, the faculty member on check-in duty at the dorm, always made a special effort to talk to her from the doorway as she settled into bed, which she found comforting. As with Fares, when she wavered on whether to return the following year, he successfully persuaded her to do so. He became her advisor and cross-country coach that year. In that capacity, he orchestrated one-on-one runs together, taking her to State Forest, Kennedy Park, and October Mountain. As he did with Fares, he fetishized her smallness. He'd been down to tie her running shoe and called her Little One. It was here, on these secluded paths, that he began sharing personal stories of his troubled youth, just as he would do with Fares, and opening up about his unsatisfying marriage. She recalls admissions director Kim Boland giving her a peculiar admonishment when she drove off campus with him in the van. "Be a good girl for Mr. Rutledge." Boland did not respond to questions sent to Miss Hall's school. Then came the touching. In his one-on-one study halls, where he'd play music and have her drape her legs over his, in the front seat of the van, where he'd have a hand on her thigh while other girls were in back. There were the mixtapes, the IMs and letters, which said things like, "I feel like a drowning man, I want to breathe you in." "Cherish them," he told her, "but delete or shred immediately." There was the same charming of her parents with gifts and gushing prose about their daughter, as if daring to hint at their secret. Her daughter, he told them in a typical report card, was the whole package. Their daily runs, he wrote, helped him out of his blue funk. There was the same thrill he got by mingling with them and taking risks behind their backs. He took Simon and her parents to Tanglewood, where Rutledge kissed her in a wooded area. Two small children happened to be running by, and they stopped to look. Simon tried to push him away, but he pulled her closer. "I want them to watch us. They need to learn." There was the same urgent promise to keep quiet, that if she ever told anyone, he'd kill himself. "As with Fares, he just created a perfect scenario to isolate me and possess me," she says. "I felt like all I needed was him." Despite her isolation, the relationship was evident to many, as it would be with Fares. He was always with Hillary, in the book locker room or the hallway, says Joe Zuber, class of 07. People would talk about Hillary having an affair with Mr. Rutledge. In the fall of Simon's senior year, her friend Allison Glueck walked in on her and Rutledge in one of his study halls to find them cuddled together. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.